Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your islands in the stream of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
If one more label try to stop me, it's gonna be some dreads even in your lobby. You don't want no problem, want no problem with me. You don't want no problem, want no problem with me. Just another day at the pickup on the mail. They gonna channel riding through the streets, they be like they go.
I too am working on the SoundCloud thing. That's one thing I have in common with Chance the Rapper. That was no problem by Chance, and Chance would like you to know, not only is he working on the SoundCloud thing, but he had a very productive call with Alex Leung, or Lung, I don't know how to pronounce the guy's last name, who is the head of SoundCloud. And apparently, if you are the type of person who gets your music from SoundCloud, shouts to Tekashi 69 and all our friends with multicolored hair dye, your music is safe for now. Like, you know,
here to stay.
Every Lil Pump song is going to be exactly where you left it. So that is a thing that happened recently and is one of several examples of trauma or confusion or chicanery happening in the streaming space. And since all of music is basically moving towards a streaming ecosystem, it seemed like a good moment to investigate what is happening with streaming and really what's going wrong, because I feel like almost every major service seems to be having some issue right now. So to discuss these things, I have convened the Music Brain Trust in the New York Times. I have Ben Cesario, who's the music business reporter in the New York Times.
Hi.
I've got Joe Coscarelli, who is the pop music reporter in the New York Times.
SoundCloud aficionado. Can I self-describe myself that way?
I would hope so. It's certainly what your live journal says.
Right.
We're going to talk about SoundCloud. We're going to talk about Spotify. We're going to talk about Pandora and Tidal. But let's start with SoundCloud. There was an interview given by, I can't quite remember, Ben, who gave the initial interview, but that indicated that SoundCloud only had about 2 or 3 months worth of basically burn rate, and that they were worried about the ongoing sustainability of the service. Is that correct?
Not exactly. I mean, like, it's been coming. Like, mm-hmm. It's been on the horizon. SoundCloud has been having money troubles, and they laid off 40% of their staff mm-hmm. a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
And it was clear looking through their financial statements that they had made these sort of warnings. TechCrunch ran a really in-depth story talking to former employees, some of the people who got laid off. There was like an all-hands meeting shortly thereafter.
Some leaked audio.
And some, yeah. And that's where that basically came out, where they seemed to sort of confirm, yes, we're going to run out of money very soon, a few months. Mm-hmm. They said the reporting was incorrect, although they really didn't dispute that fact, and it's clear from their, you know, reported statements. SoundCloud, you know, it's VC money.
Yep.
Incredibly popular.
Very user-friendly, I find, of all the streaming services, very discovery-friendly.
It's one of the only services that really has something unique to distinguish it, that artists love it, DJs love it, rappers love it. It's mm-hmm. like, it's a perfect thing for creators, whether you're at the Chance level or whether you're just some guy in your basement, it's perfect for that. And it blew up about as much as it could, which is really, really big. And then the lawyers from the music industry came after
it. Yes.
And, you know, there was infringement all over the place.
Light work.
They walked a pretty fine legal line, but eventually, you know, the suits came for them. And so about a year ago, SoundCloud introduced a subscription service, which is what the music industry wants them to do. Mm-hmm. It was not popular. There were high-ranking executives that left the company. It's in bad shape.
Is there data on that as far as a subscription?
They haven't reported anything. They haven't even updated their just like user numbers in years, and they're
suspected
to be far lower than they originally said.
Yeah, I mean, if you or I don't have a SoundCloud subscription, John, then who does?
That's totally true. You have a Chance who began on SoundCloud. You have Khalid, maybe, who started
Lord.
On SoundCloud. Lord on Absolutely. SoundCloud. Hell, should we listen to Lord?
Let's listen to a little Lord.
Let's listen to Royals. An oldie but goodie. This is like the classic rock part of the the podcast this week. Let's listen to Lord Royals. So here we are in a moment where SoundCloud is probably at its peak cultural relevance, and it is not a sustainable business model. And the industry is about to sue it basically out of existence. I noticed
don't need to sue it out of existence. It'll go bankrupt if they don't start making more money.
Mm-hmm.
They already threatened to sue them, and they got deals. Mm-hmm. So that's where the subscription thing comes in. So if you're SoundCloud, you're sitting on like gazillions of dollars of copyright infringement liability.
So is this just random
Until
users?
Until they made those deals.
Right.
Is this just random users uploading songs that they don't have the rights to? Is that the
it's
main
It's also the
users?
DJ mixes and yeah. stuff.
Right.
And ironically, like, you know, the labels – promotion staff started uploading tracks onto SoundCloud because it was so popular. And then the legal side, on the other hand, would say, whoa, 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 we can't do that. Mm-hmm.
If I'm not mistaken, old editions of the podcast that were hosted on SoundCloud were pulled down for copyright infringement. Basically, whatever the algorithm that catches yeah. audio snippets.
Because of the music.
Yeah, because of the music.
The snippets.
Yeah.
Got you.
So I think that we got pulled once or twice. Yo, shouts to the algorithm. Very thorough. Very thorough. So unlike some of these other sort of bigger behemoth streaming services, SoundCloud does still feel relatively niche in terms of the music that is popular on it and in terms of its overall scope. When Chance the Rapper comes in and says, like, basically, I'm a save SoundCloud, what does that mean in real terms? Like, in terms of people you've spoken to, like, what does it mean in terms of how is the service going to last? Are people putting new venture capital money in? Are labels giving more forgiving terms? What's happening to keep that thing running past fall?
I don't think that Chance is making it happen. I mean, maybe he is, and I don't know, but they need a
Yo,
lot
DM
of
us.
Money.
DM us. We're here. Pat, DM us.
Yeah. We're talking tens of millions of dollars. I mean, basically, they can't continue along the same lines that they are, mm-hmm. you know? They need somebody to buy them out. They can't really go to an investor and just say like, hey, could, you know—
Could we have 10 million?
Could we have 100 million?
Oh, I'm out then.
We're going to run out of it in 8 months, and then we're not going to be able to pay you back, and you're never going to make a profit, but could we have it anyway?
Right.
So there have been a few times in the past where big companies looked at buying SoundCloud. Mm-hmm. The first one was Twitter a few years ago. They walked away from it. I believe it's because the price was high, but also there was the copyright problem. Last year, Spotify also considered buying it. I don't know exactly why they walked away, but it probably had a lot to do with the price.
Mm-hmm.
You also have to wonder whether Spotify really needs it.
But is this the type of situation where a year from now, like basically Spotify can buy SoundCloud for like the equivalent of a dollar?
The scenarios that I think are batted about as the most likely is that somebody like Spotify or some other digital kind of service could sort of buy it and like bolt it on to what they already
right.
have.
Yes. And that's and the reason I say buy it for a dollar or is you bolt on SoundCloud to Spotify, but not just technologically, but also we have all these licensing arrangements. We have all these deals built in, and maybe you can somehow not grandfather, but sneak in the SoundCloud content underneath.
There's usually like terms in those deals that say if there's a change in control, the
everything's void.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, I guess the problem
they
here,
thought of that. They thought
if
of
you
that.
Start to think about it on the artistic and aesthetic side, like one of the things that is so great about SoundCloud is its sort of punk nature, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's not really following any rules and it has sort of been a breeding ground for, you know, rappers whose songs maybe aren't mixed well enough mm-hmm. to sound good on Spotify or on the radio. And John, obviously your SoundCloud rap piece from a few weeks ago encompasses this. And then the other aspect of it is that people have made this point in thinking and writing about what the demise of SoundCloud could mean and sort of drawing the parallel between something like Vine, which was another service that was owned by Twitter, had a certain tech sheen to it, but the parts of it that were really good were more underground and they were,
Black teen creativity.
Teenagers creating off-the-wall things that weren't necessarily marketable. And you see, I think, in the lack of SoundCloud being able to hold up guys like Lil Pump and Lil Peep and mm-hmm. XXXTentacion, the fact that SoundCloud can't, in good conscience, sort of say, look at the art that we are fostering. They've never been able to work hand-in-hand with these rappers.
And this is part of the struggle that came with reporting that SoundCloud rap piece, which is I really struggled having people at SoundCloud say what they had done to foster the art of the people who were the most popular on its platform. And people who worked with the artists would basically say, it's hard to work with SoundCloud, which is baffling because if you work at SoundCloud, literally what do you have to do besides help make these people more famous, more comfortable, want to use your service more?
But if so, you
the
spend
idea
a lot
that there
time,
was this burgeoning creative space.
I think there's like you spend
space.
6 weeks working on the load time for the click kind of thing. Like it's engineering of internet
but
technology.
It's, but that's like saying what we should do with the New York Times is just like re-engineer the load times for the article pages. And then me and you, we could just go to Hawaii for 6 weeks and not worry about it, preferably paid for.
I'm glad that Joe brought up Vine because I actually think that's an excellent comparison because that's kind of where we're at with like internet media where there can be like giant communities that have been created, but it doesn't matter ultimately.
If they don't make money.
Yeah, if they don't make money, there is the ability to just like pop the balloon and throw them out.
They can be disappeared.
Think about like Google Reader where like how popular that was and then one day somebody at Google just flips a switch and it doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. Because of the way internet businesses work mm-hmm. and the internet works, they can just be turned off with a switch.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that. I don't know if you guys saw the Photo Bucket thing. So Photo Bucket is now if you have stuff from back in the day, you now have to pay a kind of maintenance rate to have those photos be active on your pages and like presumably on your old Blogspot or eBay listings or things like that. And
my live journal.
Yeah, Joe's live journal's heavy photo bucket.
So
now you would have to pay,
you
would have to pay $400 a year for basically the equivalent of the iCloud drive, but it's Photo Bucket. And if not, every link that you ever put to a photo is just gone. And that's how, and like you say, that's how internet business and also increasingly internet culture is worked. Like the sort of ephemerality of it is built into it.
Yeah. The internet is littered with the bones of my old blogs, basically.
Yeah, we're going to link to all of them. I'm going to have a
but they don't even exist because MySpace gone.
Sure.
LiveJournal mostly gone. You know, they're.
I'm still going to thread your old things.
Maybe Tumblr will be gone too.
My old Tumblr. Yo, at Tumblr. You killed my Tumblr, deleted my page. That's so, it's wild unfair. Bodying.tumblr.com, it was very lit in its time, and now it's just, it's poof,
and
it's dust.
But Tumblr is another one that, although it has, you know, been such a beautiful zone for creation and dialogue and people who never would have had platforms turning into huge stars, they haven't figured out a way to make money off of it.
One
and
day
it
could Yahoo just,
well, the parent company tanked.
Right, that too. But even before that, the sale to Yahoo, you know, there was already struggles in terms of turning this into a business as opposed to just a beautiful playland for teenagers.
Have you sensed, Ben, in the last few weeks as this news has been coming out about SoundCloud, an up in sort of like copyright infringement enforcement? Because like a thing I noticed on Twitter, Rinse FM, which is like the British grime-focused radio service, their SoundCloud account was deleted altogether, presumably for excessive copyright infringement. And they were posting, you know, DJ mixes and live radio shows and things like that, or rather recordings of radio shows. Do you sense that something like that is potentially a response to the increased pressure that they're feeling right now? Or is it just like people, you know, SoundClouds die every day, B?
I'm not sure it's possible. I do know that among the people they laid off are a great deal of their engineering staff, a lot of the people who did work with artists. They actually, somebody created a spreadsheet of like former SoundCloud employees with their like, you know, personal email addresses and
LinkedIn pages.
Exactly.
Hire me.
Hire a SoundCloud engineer. It's
also
possible.
Hire a copy editor.
Yes.
Yo, real talk, hire a copy editor.
I mean, it's possible that the algorithm found that and knocked it down and like nobody was there to stop it.
Interesting.
That may be what's happening.
Like, so in essence, an account like that might have been sort of de facto protected or whitelisted, but if the person's not there to actually like press the button, could be.
I'm not sure, but yeah, it's possible.
SoundCloud is one service that's been having a lot of issues lately, but I think we should probably take a moment and just chill out while we think of the next one. We'll be back in a sec.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
That was that number one Billboard banger, A Prominent Response, by the well-known chill composer, Piotr Mateska, who's not a real person.
Nope.
Are you sure?
I don't know. I don't know what real is anymore. But no, okay, so this is one song. So Spotify has had an issue recently that has come to light. Came to light last year, but it's really come to the fore in the last month or so, which is that they populate a bunch of their playlists with music that they effectively commission and presumably at a lower rate so that they're cutting their royalty payments. Ben, you found that track for us. Tell us a little bit about where that track is from and what do we know about its provenance?
It's one of many tracks that are created by like professional composers.
Like a studio hack kind of.
Yeah, and you know, who write music for TV, write music for film. There's sort of like automatic background music that you can use to put on a YouTube video.
Mm.
It comes from this library.
Jake Paul stunts.
There's a company called Epidemic Sound in Sweden.
Okay.
Which is not far from Spotify's headquarters there.
Convenient.
In fact, they share an investor.
Ooh.
Ooh. And they employ a bunch of composers who do this, and they churn out a lot of music by the yard. This
Love
kind
it.
Of thing has sort of been a little-known part of the music industry, but a pretty big part for decades of, like, you know, background music that
Library
goes on
music.
Yeah, that goes on TV or something. Yeah. But when it came to the streaming world, they started sort of making this music and just putting phony names on the tracks.
Sure.
And artwork that kind of looks like it's from a fuzzy Instagram page or something, so that when you click on it, you see this name and you think, oh, maybe that's some Ukrainian modern composer and this is his atmospheric track and maybe that's the picture of his dog or something, you know.
Yeah. What do you think, what kind of dog does Piotr Mateska have? What kind of dog? Just guess. Do you have a husky?
Weimaraner?
What are those?
Weimaraner? Yeah, okay. All right, I'm with that.
Something that can pose.
Yeah.
Something that can
a beautiful dog.
And so it's come out that a lot of this stuff is phony to the extent that the artist credit, it doesn't really exist. It's just a pseudonym.
Let me play devil's advocate, though, because there's been library music for years made by composers or producers working in their off time. Certainly many well-known electronic music producers and hip-hop producers make interstitial music that ends up on TV shows and commercials, probably not under their real name, or at least not advertised as being under their real name. You think of like the great session musicians from the 50s and 60s. They're doing commercials. You know, they're playing on like high-level jazz records, and then they're also playing jingles. Is this different? Like, is this all like much ado about nothing?
I think to some extent it is. I mean, musically, I think, you know, it's not like this is created by a computer that has no labor cost. I mean, this is a real person making this music. They're real people. The word fake is very incendiary, and I think people got upset about that, for one thing. But I think it also touches a nerve that artists and a lot of fans think there's something unfair going on with Spotify.
Can
it's
I
come
step
up,
back and...
It's come up over and over again. Every time that there's somebody tweets like, my song got played a zillion times and I made $5,
right.
it touches something really primal about, you know, fairness and equity in the internet age and music.
And the struggle of being a creative person in the sort of, in late capitalism.
Yes.
Can I take a step back and talk through exactly how this is working and what people think is a cheat about it, Ben? And you can correct me as I go.
Sure.
So Spotify has a bunch of very popular playlists, right?
And we have to sidebar, everybody read Liz Pelley's piece, I assume, about kind of the companies that specialize in creating Spotify playlists.
Right.
Go read that.
So, for instance, if somebody's at their office job and they want chill piano and they pull up...
Quit your job, B. Quit.
And they pull up chill piano playlist, right? Chill piano playlist, that I'm making this up. It may exist, it may not. Say it has...
It'll exist now if it doesn't already.
This is a popular thing that people do, apparently. People who have office jobs, they throw on a Spotify playlist that are...
I like how we're talking about them like they're Martians.
I remember years ago, like when I first started using Spotify, there's like a white noise producer or something. And like I would put it on so I could work and just tune out the noise around.
And so Spotify knows that a lot of people are looking for this, right? So if they have a playlist called Chill Piano, maybe it's going to get 20 million subscribers and those people are going to listen to these songs on repeat all the way through, front to back from the playlist as they go about their day or in the background at their coffee shop or in their elevator or whatever. So what people fear Spotify's workaround is that instead of filling those playlists with songs by musicians to whom they would have to pay a royalty for every time the song was played, they have some backroom dealing with these professional composers and they perhaps negotiate a lower royalty rate and can then take off quote-unquote real musicians in favor of music that they have perhaps commissioned themselves for a lower cost.
Scab work.
Is that the gist of it?
I think the worst of it, and like the article in Vulture and the article on Music Business Worldwide basically said Spotify owns this stuff.
So they wouldn't have to pay
anyone.
And
they don't pay anything.
Do we know if that's true? We don't know.
I don't know for sure. Spotify denies it. They say they don't own any music. I can't prove it one way or the other, but I don't have any proof that they're lying. This company, Epidemic Sound, which represents all these composers, they insist that they're paid royalties. I had an interview with one of the composers. He says, I make decent money from this. So I think the harshest accusation is that this costs them nothing. It's a dirty deal. The more likely explanation is they're getting music from a supplier that costs less than, say, Universal.
Getting music from a label.
Right. There are composers who write under their own names and have atmospheric music. There's Brian Eno. There's Max Richter. You know, like that is a, I think, pretty recognized genre at this point. I mean, maybe does it fall into minimalism?
No, I don't think those. Not really. Maybe like Minusnewsism or something.
But so those people make their music and maybe they get put on a Spotify playlist that's popular and then their royalties checks go up. On the other hand, Spotify can just streamline people that they have an existing relationship with and potentially pay
less money. Thing that's interesting about this is that I do think Spotify is right when they're saying we didn't know this stuff was going to be as popular as it is, because I think it really has been surprising just how many plays some of these playlists get, these tracks. And we're talking hundreds of millions of plays on dozens of these playlists, and that there is a sort of like function that it provides to just like zoning out, studying.
Right. But just a couple things. One, when you trap someone inside an ecosystem, which is like a playlist or a service premised upon narrowcasting a person in some way, you actually kind of have to work hard to have a person opt out of that thing. So on the plus side, maybe Spotify is genius because they've identified a way to fill demand that the actual music marketplace is not filling. Because if they can have a quote-unquote fake musician make a song and it gets 10 million plays, then clearly there's 10 million plays worth of appetite for music like that. On the other hand, it's a little bit of a bait and switch because, like, you know, comes for Brian Eno, ends up with Piotr Mateska. But hell, maybe Piotr Mateska is the new Brian Eno.
There's another
who knows?
There's another much wonkier and more confusing side to this, which is that Spotify's royalty payments and everything are computed with these formulas that have to do with like gigantic pools of money and gigantic numbers of clicks.
Yeah.
And essentially, if you are, you know, the more clicks means that the pool of money gets divided into smaller pieces. And if there's more and more clicks with less money going out, then it ultimately kind of reduces the amount of money they're paying. It reduces the rate, which can then be used to negotiate new deals. The government gets involved in setting some of these rates with the songwriting.
Right.
And there's a kind of a dirty trick that's used over and over again, which is in these kind of things where a broadcaster or a streaming service is able to make side deals for a very low rate and then submit that as evidence to the court and say, this is what we negotiated in a fair market, and it lowers everybody's prices.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That is a fear about any time this kind of thing happens. Anytime that SiriusXM, that Spotify, that Pandora is able to sort of cram in more music for less, that is the big fear at an economic level.
Is there a counter situation to that, which is that someone like Taylor Swift, who kept her music off of Spotify for a long time and then recently reintroduced it, do we think she negotiated a better rate?
She could have.
That's a thing that happens.
It is a thing that happens.
Yeah.
And they admit this. Spotify says this, like, this is a market with different suppliers and some stuff costs more and some stuff costs less.
Mm-hmm.
This is also part of the conflict between independent labels and majors,
yes,
where the indies say, look, you know, we've got Adele, but somehow are we getting a lower rate than the other guy gets?
Given how wonky some of this stuff can get, Ben, why do you think this specific story about fake artists resonates so widely on seemingly outside of the music business world online, for instance? Like, what does this little flare-up indicate about people's suspicions towards Spotify more generally?
Well, I think it's like, it's there under the surface. I think if it was Spotify is tweaking its royalty formula, it would not catch fire. I think the idea that there's like a deception going on, fake artists, we love artists. We, you know, we go there because we like them and we want them to get paid. And the idea that the artists there are like literally phony, that they're made up, that they're created by a computer or something.
So we don't have to pay real artists.
Yeah.
But they are real, at least to the best of our understanding. They're people.
Well, like, I think eventually when there was more reporting around the situation, it was realized that, yeah, this is real stuff. At first, it was, this is fake.
Right. And I can imagine a time that could come where it will actually be fake in the algorithm. I mean, you know, if they're going to write local news articles via computer, like, why not write 4-minute fake minimal classical pieces?
There's been, like, AI music that's kind of been a thing, but I think it's interesting that for a while, a lot of the worry about the playlist business was that it's essentially a payola system.
That's a mean way to talk about Flo Rida, just FYI.
That, you know, if Spotify is the new radio and the new sort of way that hits are made, That system can be gamed. If there's money to be made, that was the worry. This is about music that has absolutely nothing to do with hits. This is instrumental, atmospheric, chill out music.
But it's a different,
it's white noise.
But it's a different kind of hit. Because this is the interesting thing about the Spotify ecosystem is there are songs that we do not consider to be valid in our in the pop music ecosystem. But if
but
songs
the
like
hit
this
is
has,
actually the playlist.
Right.
It means that the songs are interchangeable. Mm. The songs are their wallpaper, and like right. the artist name doesn't really matter.
Should we talk about Liz Pelly's piece? Because that article, a quick distillation, is that there are companies that basically specialize in creating playlists, and like occasionally there may be potentially untoward decisions being made about what gets promoted in those playlists or what's high ranked in those playlists. And all these things that seem theoretically organic are actually just the product of corporate relationships, just like everything else in the world.
And you see this, you know, I think maybe the playlist people are most familiar with on Spotify, Rap Caviar,
yes.
right? This is a constantly updated playlist of the biggest rap songs at any given moment. And, you know, people are constantly scouring it. People with these sorts of instincts and suspicions are constantly scouring it and saying, you know, how many
industry plants are
yeah, how many rappers have good placement on this playlist because the label did something to get them there, whether that's pay money or sweet talk or strong arm.
Favorite train.
Right. Like, and I think that that suspicion, like Ben, the point you made that the playlists are what's popular, that's the key here, which is that people are going to press go on track one on a popular playlist, and every song on there is going to benefit in some way from the passive music listener.
And I think maybe the fear is that the artist doesn't matter. It's the playlist which is controlled by the internet company. Mm-hmm. And if we don't like your song, we can just replace it with somebody else.
And I think the point Liz Pelly was trying to make in the piece that she wrote, which we'll link to yep. on the article page for this podcast, was basically question whose interests are being served by this curation.
Yes. That curation is not, I think.
It's not neutral.
No, it's not neutral. And I think, especially when we think of playlist, I think the term implies individualism. And implies like, it's one person, one woman, one man, just one person's feelings. But not all playlists are created alike. And obviously Spotify is geared towards playlists created either by these companies or by people with powerful interests in mind. That's true in a different way with Apple Music because there's celebrity playlists and things like that. But Spotify seems especially well geared towards that kind
of
thing.
This is why I only listen to playlists created by Jay-Z on Tidal.com.
How much longer is your Tidal subscription valid for before you have to cancel it?
You know, I have some calendar alerts set up. I got to report back.
Should we listen to 444 by Jay-Z?
Why not?
I apologize. Our love was one for the ages, and I contain this all this ratchet, and we more expansive now. Meant to cry and die alone in these mansions, or sleep with our back turned. We supposed to vacate till our backs burn. We're supposed to laugh till our hearts stop, and then meet in a space where the dark stop, and let love light the way. Like the men before me, I cut off my nose to spite my face. I never wanted another woman to know something about me that you didn't know. I promise I cried, I couldn't hold. I suck at love, I think I need a do-over. I would be emotionally available if I invited you over. I stew over, what if you over my shoe?
So, Tidal back, at least this month. Jay-Z put out his new album, 444, a couple weeks ago. And
one-week Tidal exclusive.
Yes, initially could only get it on Tidal or on Sprint via Tidal or on Sprint but maybe like with a side of Tidal, or you could just find a way to download it, which is certainly a thing that
could
happen.
Snoop did.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Yeah. I wouldn't know how to go about doing that at all, but conceptually you can do that. Tidal has been sort of legendarily challenged in the last couple of years to gain a foothold in the streaming market, which is incredibly competitive, very well resourced, and has much bigger players. Ben, a thing that I was emailing you about that I'm sort of curious about, Tidal exclusive first week numbers are not reported to your Billboards and your Nielsens. Now, obviously, my assumption is that's because they're low. But Can you expand upon the logic behind that? And then obviously Jay-Z came out in week two and is still number one. Now, admittedly, it's a slow month.
But he
still
was number one by number, a large
yes,
margin.
Yes, yeah. But he also finally released it on every platform and everybody reported, I assume. But talk to me a little bit about the logic of having that exclusive window release on a small service like Tidal and owning it, but then not actually reporting the numbers.
I think the official reason would be that it would expose their numbers since it's yes. the only place you could get it. And you can understand why any business would not want to just hand over their numbers only. Like when you see the Billboard chart, when you see the Nielsen numbers, it's an aggregate of everything.
Yeah.
So on one level, you can see why Tidal would just want to keep that, you mm-hmm. know, close to the vest. I think you're right that they're low. You know, we know that their subscriber numbers are far, far lower than Spotify, than,
right.
you know, and exactly what they are. They're much lower.
And he wouldn't debut at number one with probably only not. With only Tidal numbers.
I mean, my read of the situation was that they essentially gave up a high chart position or in order to hold their numbers. Actually, I was wrong. It was the reverse. They held the numbers, and if they had reported Tidal's numbers, they might not have opened at number one. They might have opened at number eight.
But it also—
But
it,
then going more wide the next week, he went to number one.
I'm inclined to believe that there were enough streams on Tidal that could have pushed it to number one even in the first week. It's a total guess.
DM us a spreadsheet. But, I mean, you know, you're
I mean,
a person
last year
out there
you
with
wrote about the Kanye album.
Right, so yeah. the Kanye album, they didn't report numbers when The Life of Pablo was a streaming
exclusive
on Tidal. And then, you know,
for
after
like a
some,
month, right?
Yeah, and after some, I think it was like 3 weeks, maybe 3.5 weeks, it was a messy one.
Yeah.
But, you know, after some negotiations, they gave mean numbers that they said and that were corroborated by Nielsen, I believe it was, that they gave me 10 days worth of Pablo streaming numbers. And, you know, with a lot of back of the napkin math of sort of like based on how many subscribers they have, how many times would each person have had to listen to The Life of Pablo to make these numbers right, I determined that, you know, I thought it was plausible. But it's plausible only in the sense that these Tidal exclusives are driving subscribers to the service pretty much only to listen to that new album. Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen that now. You saw it a little bit with Rihanna's Anti, which started on Tidal, Kanye's Life of Pablo, Beyonce's mm-hmm. Lemonade, which I believe still you can only stream on Tidal. And then there was a sort of long gap, right? And Tidal sort of went quiet and Sprint bought a piece of it to presumably help keep the business afloat. And then they come back with this Jay-Z exclusive. Now, this has pretty much been the only thing that Tidal makes a splash with, right? Like, pardon, that was a horrible pun. I wasn't yeah. trying to do that. No. But you know what I'm saying.
But also, and just as a sidebar to that thing, Ben, can you just explain for the benefit of the listeners, how does, in a system like this, how does Jay-Z go platinum on like his second day?
Second day?
Or third day or whatever. He went platinum basically like at birth.
Well,
platinum from the womb.
Yeah. So, I mean, the look Ben Cesario is giving me says it all.
Let me say this. Variety had a story a few days after this happened. So there was a photo that came out. Jay-Z certified platinum by the RIAA, holding the plaque. He looks real serious there. Variety had a story. It was by Jem Oswad that said the photo was actually taken before the album came out.
Amazing.
That tells you something about the music business.
Okay, so I would like to announce that Popcast has gone platinum.
Yeah,
they'll put a photo of the three of us holding maybe an iPhone up on Twitter.
Platinum with features. We're a team.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Platinum with features. No J. Cole. Yeah. Like platinum with features. So we too are I feel like if Jay-Z can say it, we can say it, right? So we're platinum.
Sure.
So we're platinum. Okay. First platinum podcast, New York Times podcast.
Yes.
Great. Okay. Now, please.
If every person listened to it 25 times.
Yes. I think that's an understatement.
I think what your average music fan might not be totally tuned into is that platinum certification comes from the RIAA, right? That's yes. separate from Nielsen. That's yeah. separate from the Billboard chart, which uses mm-hmm. Nielsen numbers. These are different ways of counting.
They're self-reported by record companies.
Right.
And interestingly, Jay-Z is both the record company and the streaming service.
And
he
the
controls
artist.
Both of them.
Wow.
And the artist.
And there's also a corporate sponsor, Sprint, which may have purchased copies of this album.
They certainly did.
They purchased them
and gave them away to their customers.
And gave them to their customers.
I think
what's
Billboard
the price
would
limit?
Have disallowed it.
I think it's $3.99.
$3.99 for it to chart on Billboard, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Each record. But the RIAA has no such price minimum.
I don't believe so.
But
let's just say
people.
That like it is chicanery, but Jay-Z's also really popular.
Yes,
you know, like
sure.
He went to number one in the second week without chicanery. So you know. And it's a good album.
I'm not knocking the Jay-Z
passing,
out.
It's really it's good. Passing the Summer in Brooklyn test.
Absolutely.
Still, I think.
Yeah, this is not a knock on the aesthetic quality of a 444.
Yes.
Not at all. It's just, there are some funny things happening.
There's some smoke in there, some mirrors, and then there's the pure
and there's
art.
Some soul.
I'm trying to keep my faith. We on a ultralight beam. We on a ultralight beam. This is a God dream. This is a God dream. This is everything. This is everything. Deliver us serenity. Deliver us peace. Deliver us love. We know we need it. You know we need it. You know we need it. Then why we need you now? Oh, pray for Paris. Pray for the parents. This is a God dream. This is a God dream. This is a God dream. We on a ultralight beam. We on a ultralight beam. This is a God dream. This is a God dream. This is everything.
That was one time title exclusive Ultralight Beam by Kanye West and friends. So Ben, earlier today, you emailed me an article about sort of a class action situation that had been litigated against Spotify, if I'm not mistaken, and then people who were exempting themselves from the class action in order to pursue additional recompense from Spotify. These are songwriters who feel that Spotify does not do a good job of pursuing rights holders and paying rights holders, and they want to extract more money from Spotify down the line for both themselves and also everybody who is in this sort of protected class of people. Spotify is partially owned by record labels, not heavily owned by record labels, but partially owned by record labels. And when I read that article that you sent me, it got me thinking, is there a version of either Spotify or any other streaming service where instead of it being a profit-seeking business, an organ that uses music as its product, the streaming of music, is there ever a possibility that one of these services will actually end up being the house organ for record labels, musicians, songwriters, other rights holders, and all those interests will be aligned? The interest of the streaming service, the interest of the musicians, the interest of the publishing companies, and I guess theoretically of the listeners. Is that ever something that could happen?
No, because it would be no good. I mean, back in the days before iTunes, like the music industry tried to have its own online music service. There were a couple of ones called Press Play.
Oh, yeah.
They were terrible.
Yeah, sure.
It basically took technology companies innovating, I'll say that word, and doing what they wanted to do. And ever since, there's sort of this tug of war with the record companies, with the music industry, where there will be a company like SoundCloud that'll come along that'll do something really interesting.
You want to say disrupt. I know you do.
I'm not going to. I already used the I word. That does something that essentially people like but runs afoul of the usual rules and regulations of the music industry. What's going on right now is basically like the hammer came down on them.
Right.
And so the music industry kind of got what they wanted out of SoundCloud, and it ruined SoundCloud, or at least hurt them really, mm-hmm. really badly. Pandora is another example where like the reason they got so big is because they were able to sort of do an end run around the music business. The way they did their licensing things was at an arm's length through government rules, mm-hmm. and that allowed them to get really big. Now they want to do business with the music industry and they're suffering. So I think that no, the music business won't control Spotify by like shareholder
right.
type. they're in a constant tug of war over the legal stuff, over the copyright. I think if they ever sort of get everything they want out of Spotify, it won't be Spotify anymore.
Right.
There won't be the free level.
Yeah.
There'll be all kinds of windowing and promotion in there. So I do think that artists legitimately have complaints and fears about how these things work because the technology companies don't work for them.
Right.
But it's really only like the creativity of the people that come up with these services that allows them to be fun in the first place.
Is this not, though, in a sense, what Tidal was designed to fix? Because you think about the Tidal launch event and you have all these musicians lined up who all say, we want something different out of streaming. We want something different out of the experience. We want something different financially. Isn't that ostensibly a step in that direction?
I think ostensibly, like, it could have been, but I think from the very start, like, from that press conference where, like, Daft Punk and Beyonce are standing up there, it looked like, well, this isn't really, like, this isn't for Michelle Schacht. This is for them to get rich.
Right.
Right?
Sure.
It's like, it's not really for musicians everywhere. It's for a cabal of really famous people to have control.
And yet I will say, just from the consumer standpoint, for all the Tidal jokes, like, its content is pretty good, you know?
Yeah.
Especially the stuff they've rolled out around 444, you know, you have inspiration playlists, you have samples playlists, you have
bonus video content.
Videos are content.
Footnotes.
Footnotes. And you have this, you know, they do this for more artists than just the boss. And if you play around on Tidal, you do get a little bit more of a sense of, you know, this is by creators for the real heads. But unfortunately, they haven't been able to put that past what you're describing, which is this idea that these rich musicians are just getting richer.
I think we have to give credit to Tidal that, like, they were predicted to die within, you know, 2 weeks, but they've lasted. Jay-Z did a deal that allowed him to essentially get his money back. It's still alive. Maybe he's at war with Kanye.
Maybe. I'm waiting for reporting on how many people at the original press conference are still
involved.
Invested in Tidal.
Well, part of the deal was that they were supposed to contribute exclusive content. And I think albums is really what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I think very few of them did that.
Yeah. Well, let's go out. Hopefully, I would like to see that reporting. I'm going to put that into the world, and then hopefully we'll
come
back to
Ben, I'll send you a Google Doc. Ben, we'll get started.
Ben, I would like to see that hopefully sometime this month. If not,
yes,
if not Ben, someone in the world. But let's go out with a song by my favorite Tidal artist owner, Jason Aldean. Let's listen to Big Green Tractor.
Didn't he eventually go back to Spotify?
I think so.
He pulled his stuff from Spotify, and then he went back.
Even better.
When the fireflies are dancing and the moon comes out, we can turn on the lights and head back to the house. We can take another ride on my big green tractor. We can go slow or make it go faster. Down through the woods and out to the pasture. Long as I'm with you, it really don't matter. Climb up in my lap and drive if you want to. Girl, you know you got me to hold on to. We can go to town, but baby, if you'd rather, I'll take you for a ride on my big green tractor.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thank you to my guests, Ben Cesario and Joe Coscarelli. Please listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us your favorite streaming service. I actually been getting a lot of emails still ranking The Lord, Katy Perry, all that. So I still
gotta forward me some of those.
I'm going to get a lot of those emails. So let's talk about streaming services. On a later podcast, I'm going to talk reader feedback. And we're going to talk about pop star rankings. We're going to talk about people's memories of Prodigy. And we'll talk about streaming. What the hell? So email us at podcast@nytimes.com. And we'll talk about it on a later episode.
Piotr Miteska, if you're out there.
If you're out there.
Let's hear from you.
Yeah, you can hit Cesario's DMs are open. just and that's just something that everyone should know, is that Ben Cesario's DMs.
As are mine.
Joe Coscarelli, that goes without saying. Joe Coscarelli's DMs definitely wild open. Please subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content, which could be a streaming service for all I know. It could be Google Play or iTunes or Stitcher. Maybe we're even on Spotify. Like, who even knows at this point? But please subscribe to the podcast. Our producer is Pedro Rosado. We'll be back next week.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.